Now to the question of genocide and what Russia is doing to the Ukrainian people. This discussion of genocide and crimes against humanity is disturbing, so please use your discretion. President Biden stood by his comments calling Russia's actions in Ukraine genocide, telling reporters as he boarded Air Force One 3 weeks ago in Des Moines.
I called it genocide because it's become clearer and clearer that Putin is just trying to wipe out the idea of even being able to be a Ukrainian.
Join in on the nature of the violence committed by Russian forces, how you see it, 800-642-1234. Scott Strauss is a political science professor at University of California, Berkeley, focuses on political violence, genocide, human rights, post-conflict politics. Scott, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's go right to the heart of this. Is what's happening, as you see it in Ukraine, genocide in your estimation?
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky question. It's a really emotional question. And sort of before I give you my sort of professorial or scholarly account, I mean, I think it's really important to recognize that from the point of view of the Ukrainian population, that what they're experiencing, you know, is atrocious, is awful, is terrible, right? This is a war of aggression. There is significant violence being committed against civilians. You know, at least 3,000 civilians have been killed, serious sexual violence, you know, forced displacement, and so forth. So I think from the point of view of the victims and those who are suffering it, and suffering the violence, I think sometimes this can feel like a semantical, you know, and not that important of a discussion. I do think it's an important discussion to have, but I think it's one that I think it's important just to foreground it by acknowledging what's been happening to the victims in Ukraine. I think genocide is, you know, genocide is defined by a coordinated pattern of action aiming at the destruction of a group, you know, intentional group destruction. And I think from those, you know, for those who are arguing that it's genocide, not only President Biden, but also many Ukrainians, I think what they're experiencing and what they're observing is an effort to destroy the Ukrainian nation. You know, President Putin doesn't recognize Ukraine. He wants to absorb it, it seems, into Russia. And from that point of view, I think in general, it feels like an effort at the destruction of a group. I would say it's probably a little early to make that call. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible at the end of the day that we would conclude that it is genocide. To me, I don't think we have enough evidence to show that pattern of action, that it's the destruction of a group. I think what we can see clearly at this stage are, you know, mass atrocities, crimes against humanity, war crimes, which are really bad. And, you know, there's no hierarchy in international law about different kinds of crimes. So I think it's important, again, just to recognize that what we're observing here is extremely bad. And we can talk about how to categorize it, but it is extremely bad.
Scott, why does it matter what specific label we apply to atrocities in Ukraine? I mean, you know, aren't atrocities against civilians atrocities? Why does this genocide label matter?
I think first of all, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think these are mass atrocities. These are widespread violence against civilians, as tremendous civilian suffering. And really, that's the sort of fundamental point to acknowledge. I think beyond that, there's a couple different reasons why it matters. I mean, one is there's a sort of legal world out there. And one of the things that's happening are people are building legal cases against Russian authorities, potentially against Russian soldiers. And there you're looking at different charges, right? There's a charge of genocide. There's a charge of crimes against humanity. There's a charge of war crimes. I think that's one element. I think the concept of genocide also has this very powerful moral element to it, right? It's in many people's imagination, the worst of what human beings do to each other. It has an association with the Holocaust. It has an association with what happened in Rwanda in 1994 and Bosnia and other cases that I think we recognize as some of the worst atrocities that humans commit. And so in that sense, I think there is an emotional appeal, a moral appeal. There's a kind of brand sense that comes with genocide. And I think from the point of view of the Ukrainians in particular, I think they want to draw attention. It's a way of drawing attention to the suffering, the level of suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think from President Biden's point of view too, I think he wants to say that President Putin is doing horrible things. And he's called him a war criminal, and now he's using the term genocide. And so I think it's a way of getting at that emotional element.
Oh, the rhetoric matters. Let's bring on Peter in Madison. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, I just was wondering if your guest can comment on the Russians. They always accuse the U.S. and Ukraine of committing genocide and about the people in Donbass. And it's just a matter of, you know, which side screams the word genocide the loudest that seems to make the biggest difference, especially in the point of view of the neutral countries that are not particularly aligned with the U.S. or Russia. How do they make a distinction between the claims that the U.S. are making and the claims that the Russians are making?
That's a great question, Peter, that rise of genocidal rhetoric and ideology. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I think Peter's absolutely right. I mean, there is a kind of propaganda war going on right now globally. There's a war of information. And President Putin, you know, justified his intervention and the war in Ukraine on the basis that Russian speakers were experiencing genocide in Donbass, in some parts of Ukraine. And I don't think there's any evidence of that either, by the way. And I think that there's no evidence whatsoever that I've seen of that being possible. I think you do have some minorities in that area, but I don't think they're experiencing genocide. And I think the point is that this term genocide does get politicized. It becomes weaponized in wartime, and it becomes part of a propaganda machine, a war of information. And I think we've seen that in this conflict for sure. But I think people, look, I hope at the end of the day that this will be an evidence-based conversation. And President Putin has supplied no evidence that I've seen that genocide is being committed. By contrast, on the Ukrainian side, I think there is extensive documentation of the crimes that have been committed and continue to be committed. And I think that documentation ultimately will be part of legal cases, but I think part ultimately of the rhetorical conversation that goes on about whether or not it's genocide.
Talking with UC Berkeley political science professor Scott Strauss studies how and why large-scale political violence occurs in the world, like genocide. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up ahead on the Ideas Network. Now, the Kremlin has repeatedly denied targeting Ukrainian people or committing other war crimes. Please be aware that this conversation about war atrocities could be disturbing. The International Criminal Court and other prosecutorial agencies are looking at the possibility of war crimes, human rights violations in Ukraine. Join in on the human toll of war, your perspective, 800-642-1234. Conversation is at 800-642-1234. Scott Strauss, political science professor at UC Berkeley, written multiple books on genocide and mass atrocities, stays with us. Scott, let's zero in on the United Nations. There's an effort by the UN to document the potential war crimes happening in Ukraine. Can you tell us about what this documentation is like?
Yeah, I think there's very extensive documentation going on inside of Ukraine, and it's sort of coming from multiple levels, right? I think you're seeing, you know, one of the incredible things about the democratization of technology is that individual citizens who see people having been killed or experienced something are taking pictures or recording it on their phone and so forth. There's that element. There's the Ukrainian authorities that have set up hotlines, that have teams of prosecutors and investigators who are going into the areas where the Russians had occupied or where they had bombed, and they're documenting what's been going on. And then, as you mentioned, you also have investigators from the International Criminal Court who also have teams on the ground, as well as other United Nations agencies that have teams on the ground. And there seems to be pretty good coordination across these different levels. And so my sense is that what's happening here is that they're building legal cases either to be brought eventually at the International Criminal Court or potentially within Ukraine or potentially within other countries. And it's pretty extensive documentation.
I'm thinking about Mariupol and, you know, just 90% of it destroyed from shelling and the airstrikes, and can't even get, a civilian corridor open to get people out. I'm just wondering if it's difficult to be able to do this documentation in the throes of war. And then if you go in later, is it, are you able to even have a reliable way of understanding the exact scale of the atrocities that occurred?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that essentially people are doing censuses of who got killed, how many people got killed. And obviously in the middle of a theater of war, it's very difficult to do that. Again, you could have individual citizens who would take pictures, who would document it, who would record a bomb exploding and that kind of thing. I think where you've seen probably more precise documentation is where Russian troops have retreated. So in a place called Bucha, where there were, you know, really incredibly atrocious behavior, where it looks like many civilians had been tied, had been captured, and had been executed, you know, with shots to the head, quite significant sexual violence being reported in Bucha. And so in that area where Russian forces had retreated, you're seeing, I think, pretty extensive documentation and pretty capable documentation there going on. But you're right, in a place like Mariupol or other areas where there's on, you know, there's active fighting and active shelling, it can be quite difficult for the kind of documentation needed to build the legal case, for sure.
As you look at then, and we're going to talk more about international courts here in just a moment that have rarely ruled that a genocide has occurred. And, you know, this has given rise to accusations of inconsistency and putting genocide on a pedestal. And I want to really look at that next, at what happens in the level of the courts. As we talk with Scott Strauss here, you can join in. Scott Strauss, UC Berkeley political science professor, 800-642-1234. As we look at the lens in the large-scale political violence in Ukraine and around the world, we'll pick this up. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Now to Ukraine, where United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres visited sites of suspected war crimes Thursday, and he urged Russia to accept to cooperate with the ongoing investigation by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, standing outside bombed-out rubble in a Kyiv suburb.
Innocent civilians were living in these buildings. They were paying the highest price for a war for which they had not contributed at all.
We're discussing the human toll of war, so please be aware of the nature of this conversation. Scott Strauss, political science professor at UC Berkeley, a scholar of genocide. Let's bring on a caller now. Austin is with us from Kenosha. Austin, hi. What would you like to add?
Hi. I would just like to talk about the historical context of, like, the United States and our criticisms of these war crimes. Because, like, you know, we're currently committing genocide on indigenous and migrant communities. You know, I live like a couple miles from a concentration camp, an ICE concentration camp in Kenosha. And like, you know, we committed genocide in Iraq. We funded death squads in Latin America. And like, you know, it's just interesting. And then we're also wanting to sic the ICC on Putin. But like, you know, our war criminals like Donald Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney are walking free.
So Austin, really wanting to look at the historical perspective here, Scott, and put the lens on the U.S. Go ahead.
Well, I think there are a couple really important points here. I mean, I would disagree with some of the characterizations about the U.S. committing genocide in Iraq and with migrants, but maybe we'll come to that second. But I think the really crucial point here is, like, is there hypocrisy on the part of the United States? And much of the world reacts just as Austin did when the United States gets up there and says, hey, you know, Russia's committing genocide, and says, well, there was the invasion of Iraq. You know, there was this, I mean, some of the things that he mentioned, and a sense that the United States is only going to pursue legal redress for the International Criminal Court when it's fighting its enemies, but when it's dealing with its allies, it's not, you know, it's not going to do that. And so I think there is a real question of the legitimacy of these actions, questions of hypocrisy and so forth. And I think that's part of this sort of war of information that's going on globally right now. And I think it's incumbent upon the United States, when it makes these allegations, to show that they care about, that the policymakers care about these issues. It's not that they're using these issues to delegitimize their opponents. And I think that's a fundamental issue. I think genocide is about the intent to destroy groups. And I wouldn't have said that was the, I don't think there's an evidence for that in terms of US behavior in Iraq. I think there's also not, I wouldn't characterize treatments of migrants in that way either. And I think in some ways it gets also to this question of like, there's so much pressure on this one word, genocide, that there are many ways of describing violence against civilians or human rights abuses on a large scale that doesn't necessarily have to be genocide in order for us to criticize it, potentially bring a legal case or whatever. And I think that's also part of this conversation.
Do you think international courts have stayed away from, genocide in terms of putting it on this kind of out of reach pedestal from a legal standpoint?
Yeah, I mean, because the threshold for genocide is the intent to destroy groups in whole or in part, that's the legal threshold. That special intent, proving special intent, can be very difficult. You kind of have to either get into the minds of the perpetrators or deduce their statements and infer an intent in that way, or you can infer intent from the pattern of action on the ground. And the challenge is to prove that what the objective is to destroy groups. And that can be very difficult to do. It can be done, but it's often very difficult to do. So typically when there are these charges, and what I would expect here with Ukraine down the road, is that you're gonna see a series of charges being laid against Russian authorities, Russian generals, President Putin, perhaps eventually. And I think those would include, war crimes. War crimes are intentional targeting of civilians or prisoners of war. Then there's crimes against humanity, which can occur either in war or out of war, which are widespread or systematic attacks against civilians. And I think both of those charges are pretty straightforward in this case. Like I think it would be very easy to provide the documentation to sustain those charges. And the harder one is going to be genocide, which is about having to establish the special intent to destroy groups. And I think that's going to be a harder one. I imagine he might eventually be charged that way, but proving it is going to be quite difficult.
Let's bring in Frank in La Crosse. Frank, go ahead. What is on your mind?
Good morning. I'd like the professor's response regarding the Russian illegitimate seat in the United Nations Security Council, as the Ukraine foreign minister raised, when the Soviet Union disbanded and the new entity, Russia, with or without Ukraine, became a new national entity, it never was seated on the Security Council. And he raised the question as some formal vote that the General Assembly would have to take. And I've never seen anybody raise that question beyond the foreign minister from Ukraine. So I wonder what the professor's response is that take Russia off the Security Council and their veto power is removed.
Frank, thank you. On the UN Security Council, Scott.
Yeah, so on the Security Council question, I think that baked into the architecture of the United Nations was a distribution of power that reflected the end of World War II, the winners of World War II. And so Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time, was given veto power, as was the United States, China, Britain, and France. So pretty much on this conflict, the Security Council is going to be dead water for any kind of resolution that's going to go against Russia. So I don't expect that to happen at all. And I think, in other kinds of crises, the same is true for China or reverse for the United States. Regarding the sovereignty of Ukraine, I don't know the specific history to which you're referring about a vote to recognize Ukraine within the General Assembly. But I think many people would acknowledge Ukraine as an independent country and has sovereignty. That sovereignty has been recognized across the world. Much of the Soviet Union broke up into independent countries. There's Kazakhstan, there's Lithuania, there's Georgia, there are number of other countries. So I think very few people would dispute the legal sovereignty of Ukraine. And to the extent that Russia doesn't recognize it, I think that's really the prerogative of the Russians rather than a kind of global view. And once we start to get into the question of is sovereignty recognized across all of these different countries that have operated as independent countries, you know, then we're really moving back into a really different era of international order, which is a much more dangerous situation than we've been living with really since World War II, maybe even since World War I. So, you know, I think this is a very dangerous path that Russia is pursuing that could lead to, you know, quite a bit of international disorder.
There are observers who are really worried about escalation and that this could escalate to genocide. And you have so much background in atrocities and genocide in other parts of the world. How do you see that perhaps unfolding here in Ukraine as you make comparisons to genocides that you've studied, like Rwanda?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm a little bit on the fence. I don't really yet see the ingredients for genocide, but I think that this is a very unstable dynamic situation that could evolve in a couple directions that would bring us there. So clearly the fact that there is a war going on is one of the central ingredients of genocide. Almost any genocide that has occurred historically in the last 100 years has occurred in wartime. And so war just kind of escalates the level of violence. It makes perpetrators much more willing to use violence against civilians as they pursue their war aims. I think another big ingredient has to do with, you know, with nationalism and a vision of what kind of state one wants. And I think here, Putin has said that he doesn't recognize the Ukrainian people, or doesn't recognize the Ukrainian nation. And so you also have, you know, that element, which both of which are real indicators of potential for genocide. What I don't see here yet is the rationale for the destruction of the Ukrainian people as such. And by destruction, I mean here the physical destruction, the biological destruction of a group. And what I mean by that is I think what you see in other genocides is a kind of calculation that in order to win, in order to prevail, you have to eliminate a group or eliminate a very substantial part of that group in order to prevail. And I think Russia's view is that the Ukrainians are brainwashed. And if they can take over Ukraine and absorb it into Russia, or parts of Ukraine and absorb it into Russia, it'll become a kind of satellite of Russia. But that they're not necessarily seeing this, this Ukrainian identity as being too deeply rooted within the Ukrainian people, that they would need to eliminate or remove them in order to succeed. When that starts to be the calculation, right? When we start to hear that the Ukrainian people are fundamentally problematic and fundamentally brainwashed, we can't figure them out, we need to get rid of them, they either need to flee or we need to get rid of them. That's when I think I would see the conditions for genocide emerging. And I think right now it seems to me primarily a war of acquisition, of territorial annexation, rather than genocide per se. Again, a war in which crimes against humanity, in which war crimes have occurred, and that's clearly a war of aggression, meaning that there's an illegal invasion of another country. Absolutely.
In our few last moments left, how could the U.S. government do more to prevent mass atrocities?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that's part of what President Biden and others are doing, which is to kind of essentially issue warnings, right? Mm-hmm. To say, you know, the world is watching, they're issuing warnings, that kind of thing. I think that they can certainly aid legal mechanisms, so lending expert prosecutors or investigators to the International Criminal Court, mm-hmm. or possibly even to Ukraine, providing resources to do that, perhaps providing, you know, intercepted transcripts or satellite imagery or photo documentation. Those kinds of things, I think, will be material support.
Intelligence.
And I think the rhetorical arguments also are persuasive. So I think those are some, the U.S. has had a sort of ambivalent relationship to the International Criminal Court to date. It has not ratified the treaty that sets up the court. So the United States is not formally a state's party to the International Criminal Court. But what's been really interesting in this conflict is that you're seeing some of the lawmakers who have previously opposed the court, who are now wanting to support it in order to aid it in bringing a case against Russia. So there's an interesting realignment going on around the International Criminal Court that I think will be very much worth watching going forward.
Scott, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Scott Strauss is a political science professor at UC Berkeley, where he studies political violence and genocide, was a professor at UW-Madison for 17 years. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.